I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Ever since she was 11 years old, Phyllis Corky had wanted to write a book. In fact, it was something she had thought about for the last 40 years. She was working at the New York Times, where she is an assignment editor and reporter for the Sunday Business section, on a column about deadlines. And that got her thinking about what prevented her from completing this long-term passion project. So, killing two birds with one stone, she wrote a book about why she hadn't written a book. And it's titled The Big Thing, How to Complete Your Creative Project Even If You're a Lazy, Self-Doubting Procrastinator Like Me. Corky talked with psychologists, neuroscientists, artists, adventurers, business executives, even a nutritionist and breathing specialist to learn more about deadlines, about motivation, fear of failure, taking breaks, routines, and much, much more. Well, we wanted to know more and asked her to join us on Radio Times. In fact, she joins us from the NPR studios in New York. And Phyllis Corky, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
How does someone who works as a reporter at the New York Times meet deadlines if you are a self-described procrastinator?
Well, there's a specific kind of deadline I don't meet. It's the kind I set for myself for a personally meaningful creative project that has no firm deadline. If I'm accountable to coworkers and I have to do something for someone else, and if I don't do it, I will let them down, then I'm a really hard worker and I do meet my deadlines. It's myself I don't mind letting down.
Which leads to a whole bunch of questions here. Why, as a little girl, though, at 11 years old, did you want to write a book?
Well, that's just, I've always loved books. I've read books from an early age, and it was just always something that I wanted to do. I read Jane Eyre at the age of 11, and I've always been under the spell of the Bronte sisters, and I wanted to write my own book like that.
Well, I'm looking at your subtitle where you call yourself lazy. I circled that because that's name calling.
Yes,
and I don't think that's particularly productive. But it's in the subtitle there, and you write a lot about laziness. What do you mean by that?
Well, it is a self-critical kind of label, and that's deliberate. It's tongue in cheek in a way because I'm actually not lazy. If you talk to my coworkers, they would say that I'm definitely not lazy. So it is something that it's a label you put on yourself that can get in your own way, and that's my very point in putting it in the subtitle.
And how having that self-described label, how has that gotten in your way, or how did that get in your way?
Well, you say I'm such a lazy person. And it's such an overall kind of label that you don't tend to get into the reasons why. And it's not that I'm lazy, it's that I'm afraid. I'm afraid of failure. That's more of what it is than laziness.
Do you think that's kind of at the root of procrastination and why all of us put off things that we care deeply about?
Yes, that's so much why. We are paralyzed by possibilities, and our need to be perfect stops us from doing anything and from even starting at all.
Does that describe you, this sort of need, desire to be perfect?
Yes, I think so. You get this grandiose idea in your head. Say you want to write a novel, which is something I've wanted to do, and you think you get this idea in your head that it's going to be this wonderful thing, and then you try to start, and it's just this paltry, pathetic little thing that does not match the grandiose idea that you had. And so it causes you to stop.
Is it the grandiose idea? Is that also part of the problem? I mean, writing novels is really hard. I've never written one, but I've interviewed a lot of novelists.
It is. And what I point out is that this grandiosity relates to narcissism. And it's actually narcissism not to work on a big thing, because that way it can remain perfect in your head. And because you haven't done it.
Explain what you mean by that. Flesh that out.
Well, okay, narcissism means that you have this overweening sense of your own importance. And so say you want to write a novel, and then it starts building up and up and up in your head. It's going to be this great classic. You know, for me, it'll be the next Jane Eyre or something. And then you start to write it, and suddenly you realize how hard it is, and it's nowhere near the caliber of what you were expecting. And so support this idea of yourself as being this paragon of perfection, you stop doing it, because that way you can just rely on your potential. And you can, you know, your future self can do the work someday, and your future self will be perfect at it and write the classic, the modern American classic.
What a fantasy, right?
Yes, it is a fantasy.
Let me go to another word that you have in your subtitle, self-doubting. And you do include, towards the end of the book, a therapist telling you in your 30s that you did doubt yourself, that you had a lot of self-doubts. Tell us more about that.
Well, my therapist said I tended to discount everything that I did. Anything that I managed to accomplish, I would just say, well, that's not a very big deal.
Oh, goodness.
It's the kind of Groucho Marx theory that, you know, any club that would have me,
right.
You know, is it worth joining? And anything that I ended up actually accomplishing, I would immediately say, well, that's not a very big deal.
So tell us then, I mean, in certain ways, you almost tricked yourself into writing this book,
yes.
Right?
Yes, I did. And I one thing I realized that works a lot, and I highly recommend to anyone who wants to do a big project, is to create fake accountability.
Fake accountability. All right.
Yes.
Again, flesh that out for us.
Yes. So that's a way of forcing yourself. It's the way when I wrote that column on deadlines and I told my colleagues, I'm going to get this done. And, you know, I'm going to get it done on Thursday. And there was no way I would not do it because, well, there was a space in the paper and I had said I would do it. Well, I needed to create that same sense of accountability for this project that didn't actually have a firm deadline. So what I did, what I finally came up with, is I put an ad on Craigslist. And I said, I will pay someone $200 to call me every morning at 7 a.m. and check with me and make sure that I'm starting to write my book. Then call me back again at 9 a.m. and make sure that I have done it. And scold me if I haven't done it and congratulate me if I have.
And you got a dairy farmer to do this, right?
Yes. I got 80 responses. There were a lot.
That's terrific.
I think that I was offering way too much money for that. I could have gotten by with $50 for that, but because it's not very many. It doesn't take a lot of time to call someone. And I got a lot of responses, but I got this one from a dairy farmer in Washington State saying, you know, if you don't mind someone calling you from across the country, I'll be getting up and milking my cows at 4 a.m. my time, and I would be happy to call you. And then I'll be round about the time that you're finishing, I'll be waking up my 7 children. And she was she was perfectly happy to call me during that time.
And did it work?
Worked. It totally worked. I was so nervous, and I got up and waited for her to call, and she called me. She said, how are you doing on your project, Phyllis? She was so upbeat. She was the perfect person to call me. And so there's no way I was going to let her down. And of course, I could have lied, but I'm from Minnesota and I'm a really honest person and I just can't lie. And so she called. And what was really funny is Thursday, I got up, I was sitting at my desk and she didn't call. And I was so worried. And then finally she called at like 8:30 my time. And she said, oh, I'm so sorry, Phyllis. One of my children had a cold and we fell asleep on the couch together and I woke up late. So that was kind of fun.
That's life. But you do describe your early morning routine. And I have to say, it sounds a little bit like some lollygagging around in your bed, reading books.
Scandinavian mysteries.
Reading mysteries, maybe falling back to sleep. So,
this
was a problem, I guess.
Yes. And Stephen King wrote this book on writing, and he says you have to get up every single morning and work on your writing. And he said, you know, the only times I don't write are on Christmas and my birthday. And then later he confessed he did write on those days. And it's like, wow, how could I? And then I think to myself, a lot of times I say I'm going to write and then my cat, you know, it's my cat's fault, really, because she just sits up on my stomach and starts purring. And how could I get up then? And then there's this really good mystery. I have to find out whodunit. There's all kinds of things that get in the way. And then pretty soon it's time to go to work and I haven't done it. Well, what I realized is that even if you don't work on it sometimes and you your cat does prevent you from doing it or you do something else, you can still get it done.
Well, there you go.
You don't have to be perfect.
Well, it sounds like this dairy farmer who called you every day was a lovely woman. Did she ever have to berate you? And would have berating you gotten you to work more on your book?
Well, I couldn't bear the thought of her berating me. I think so, and so I didn't get to that point. I just could not. I couldn't stand the thought of her doing that. And some people, I think, do need the negative incentive. And there's a psychologist named Dan Ariely who talks about that. And he says if you want a negative incentive, you can do something like write a check out to an organization that you abhor, give it to a friend, and say, if I don't do my writing assignment, send this check for, you know, $100 to this terrible organization that I absolutely detest. And, you know, maybe it'll show up in the public records even, who knows. Or, you know, even have them, you know, call you out on Facebook. Phyllis didn't write her 1,000 words today. Shame on her. Things like that.
It'd be interesting to know what works. I'm not sure.
You know, different people
the
carrot have different.
Or the stick.
Yeah, right. And you know, it sounds kind of corny. It sounds kind of ridiculous. But the fact is, it works. People don't like to be publicly shamed.
Well, it's interesting that you made your dairy farmer almost act like your colleagues in that you don't want to disappoint your colleagues at the New York Times, and you did not want to disappoint this dairy farmer who you were paying her, but nonetheless investing some of her time and energy to make sure that you got this book done.
Yeah, and I don't know if everyone's like that, but I think a lot of people are that way. And you can do that, too. It's not like you have to pay someone. A lot of people have accountability buddies. I actually did that with another woman who had applied for the job to call me. And she was writing a memoir called Scandalous about her scandalous past. And after the dairy farmer, we actually just called each other and texted each other and said, hey, are you work? Did you get up yet? You know, come on, you can do it. You got to get in that chair and start writing. And that worked too. I think the dairy farmer was better though.
I had money. And what a great story to have.
Yeah, I had money in the game.
Absolutely. Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation talking with Phyllis Korke about the fact that she had for decades wanted to write a book, for whatever reason, did not write this book. And then she wrote a book about why she didn't write the book. And it's called The Big Thing, How to Complete Your Creative Project, Even If You're a Lazy, Self-Doubting Procrastinator Like Me. And she works at The New York Times. She's an assignment editor, reporter for the Sunday Business section. If you want to join the conversation, I'm sure many of you can relate to what we're talking about. I certainly can. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. If you have a big thing that you want to accomplish, give us a call. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and do stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moskowang talking with Phyllis Korke about the things that we want to do, the big creative things that we want to do, and yet we can't start them or we can't finish them. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Her book is called The Big Thing. What did you learn from psychologists? You mentioned one earlier, but you talked to a number of psychologists and looked at some of the writings of some of the other psychologists who have talked about some of these issues. And what did you learn from what they say about what prevents us from doing these big creative projects?
Well, I think I learned that there is just a lot of tendency to procrastinate, again, because of this narcissistic issue that we have. And also, there's this, a lot of people, there was one psychologist who talked about there's chronological age. We sometimes think we have to do things when we're young, but life actually gets in the way. And there's just this horrible psychic overhang that starts to develop over time. But psychologists have found that you can keep this flame alive for decades, and then say when you're children have grown up or after you get a divorce or something like that, it can come into full force again, and you can do it. And I'm an example of that.
So the idea of sort of holding on to this idea or this creative dream, not saying, in your case, Phyllis, after 40 years, I'm never going to write a book, that you can still accomplish something like that.
Yes, but there are exceptions to that. Sometimes I have a whole chapter on giving up, too, where you have to really analyze what is the true reason you want to do this. Now, is it more than 50% for acclaim from others? This taps into the narcissism again. You want admiration and acclaim. You want to be famous. What I point out in this book is that you have to mainly want to do this for the intrinsic rewards and not for the extrinsic awards. I talked to somebody who did some research on that, and it has to be personally meaningful in the main. You can't hope that it's going to make you rich and famous. If that's the main reason you're doing it, you probably should give up on it.
I mean, you have to want to do this for yourself. I mean, it sounds like
yes.
That's what you're saying. Bottom line, it has to be for yourself.
Right. Right. And that's why this book really fell into that category for me, regardless of how it does in sales or anything like that. It feels really good and fulfilling that I did it.
As you're talking, I'm thinking about the conversations that we're constantly having with ourselves about whether we're good enough or we're not good enough, or just the sort of ongoing monologue that we have going
yes.
on in
yes.
our head. And it's funny when you analyze it, there is a lot of that sort of beating up of ourselves that we do that we might never do to a friend or a colleague or a
yes.
family member, but we seem so justified in doing to ourselves.
Yes, I do that all the time. I just am constantly beating on myself for never being good enough. And they're really, what's the point? And and sometimes that's when you really have to sit down. Maybe you even do need to go to a therapist, because there's the psychic overhang can really take a toll. And if you are somehow thinking to yourself that I am not a valuable person because I haven't written a novel, you know, you need to have some therapy maybe to realize, well, maybe that's not what I'm supposed to be doing. And really just my day-to-day life is my big thing. Just having a garden and playing with my cat or my dog and being a good parent, maybe that's my big thing in life.
And being okay about it, right? I mean, those are big
yes.
things, right? Being a good person.
I mean, I don't have children myself, but, you know, raising children, that is a really big thing, and that is something that leaves a legacy, and that in itself is important. And why should you feel you have to do something else, like write a play or start a business? Or it just might not be realistic, and you're doing it for the wrong reasons.
We have an email from Kyle saying almost exactly what you're saying. My goal is to make more deep and meaningful connections with family, friends, and coworkers in 2017. I guess a kind of a New Year's resolution, but it does pick up on this theme that, I mean, you know, I'm never going to write a great novel. I know that about myself, but perhaps there are other things that are meaningful that, you know, maybe the world won't know about, but maybe a handful of people will know about.
And they will have an influence. It's the butterfly effect. You just never know what you do, how it might affect the world.
You also consulted a nutritionist. You went to a breathing expert. Why was that part of your process of understanding why you weren't able to complete this project?
Well, because when I got the book contract immediately, so then my editor wisely had me do monthly deadlines, and I had to get started. I was accountable to somebody, really. And I went into this tailspin of anxiety, and I went to my doctor and I said, can you please give me some Klonopin? Because I'd had some Klonopin briefly 10 years ago, and it was so nice. And she refused. She said it was addictive. And I thought, what am I going to do? I was having these stomach pains. I was having the shortness of breath. I was having back pain. Because how was I going to write this book? There was no way I was going to be able to do it. It was going to be horrible. And so I thought, I have got to turn to my own body and not have it turn against me. So I went to a breathing specialist, and she made me realize that I've been breathing wrong. I've been breathing from my shoulders, and I've been breathing vertically. And that's the worst possible way to breathe. What you want to do is breathe from your diaphragm, which is much lower down, and breathe horizontally. What this does is bring more blood to your brain, and it calms down your stomach.
And did that help you?
It has helped me to this day.
Really?
I cannot tell you how. I recommend everybody take a breathing lesson, and there's a lot of things I haven't mentioned. I mean, it's more involved than that. You really need to take a lesson and have somebody analyze the specific way that you breathe. But you would be surprised, and it's better than a prescription for Klonopin, is to breathe from the lower part of your body and breathe horizontally. And there's things in your inhale and your exhale. It's how children breathe, but then society just has its way with us and makes us breathe in the totally wrong way that is totally counterproductive.
So that helped with what? Things like fatigue or energy, low energy?
And anxiety.
Yeah.
Yes, that was the main thing, is that, you know, my stomach started just, you know, it was hurting so much and the back pain and everything. And I also took posture lessons, which doesn't immediately make sense maybe, but it made me in touch with my own body. And she said one thing, and this is one thing I'll share with you. She said, imagine the top of your head. And it's funny, because usually when you try to have good posture, you get all you know, you get all ramrod straight and tense. But this just sort of gently has you move your head towards the sky. And it grounds you, too. You move your feet, you ground your feet, and you have arrows coming out of the sides of your shoulders. And basically, you're inhabiting your own space. And the Alexander technique, which I learned, has a concept called end gaining, where you leap ahead of yourself. And so you're there before you're there. And so, but to work on a big thing, you have to be right in the moment and where you are. And your physical position is very much a part of that.
Was that a revelation to you, all of this?
It really was. And if you have back pain, before you have surgery, I would recommend posture lessons, because they very gently bring you in back in touch with your own body and have you take up your own space, which we really need to do in life. We forget about the mind-body connection when we're working on an intellectual big thing.
Well, let me quickly reintroduce you. That's Phyllis Korke, and she is an assignment editor, reporter for the New York Times Sunday Business section, and she's got a new book called The Big Thing, How to Complete Your Creative Project, Even If You're a Lazy, Self-Doubting Procrastinator Like Me. And she's been talking about the things that she learned in order to be able to write this book. And you can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And we are talking about those big things like learning another language or perhaps writing a poem or doing something in the business world that you have been thinking about, some of these big projects. Let me go back to you, Phyllis, and then we got some folks that want to join our conversation. This is about nutrition, and you write that basically for breakfast you would have a cinnamon roll, and that took you on a bit of a roller coaster. Explain, I guess, that habit and what you did to substitute for that.
Well, I talked to a nutritionist at Arizona State University, and she was saying I was doing it all wrong, because something like a cinnamon roll will give you a quick rush, and then you'll have a quick letdown. And it's really best to have protein for breakfast and also for lunch. I couldn't believe this, she actually would just have a can of Bush's beans for lunch sometimes. And she said that was actually a pretty good thing to have.
Really?
Protein is brain food. It makes sense. And it's sustained brain food. And then she actually said it's okay to have pasta for dinner, because that makes you sleepy, and sleep is so important too.
And have you kept these habits in your life?
I've stopped eating that cinnamon roll.
You did.
I tend to have eggs and things like that for breakfast.
And that has helped?
Yes, it really, you know what that sugar crash feels like.
I do.
You can't do anything after you have that.
Let me see what Margot looks like. Margot from Medford Lakes has to say. Margot, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just wondering, is there a time of the day that you are more productive, and how did you get yourself to focus, sit down and sequester yourself and focus on this rather than getting bombarded by all of your responsibilities and just, especially now, current events.
Yes. Current events that are, yes, distracting everybody. Margo, yes. Margo, is there a big thing that you're wanting to do?
I actually do want to write a book, and I keep on going through everything that your guest has so far said about, like, I'm not good enough, and I suck, and what makes me think that anyone would want to read this book. But I mean, I do have some help in the wings. So it's really just my own fear of taking that plunge, I think, that's keeping me from doing it.
I hear you. Well, Margo, let me see what Phyllis has to say, and I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Phyllis, any advice?
Well, I'm glad you brought up time of day, because you hear this, there's this gospel of you've got to get it done in the morning. And as I write in the book, I tended not to be able to get it done in the morning. And then I had these 2 months off, or no, it was a month off, that I took, that I, a little bit of a leave that I had from work, and I still didn't get things done. But what I realized is I tended to write at night when I was running out of time. I needed to, and then what I realized is I needed to have time running out, because I had monthly deadlines. I needed to have time running out in the month, in the night, and in my life in order to get my big thing done. And so everyone has their own different way of doing it. And so if you're realizing, I realize once I know that there are just a few hours left in the day, that gets me to do it.
Oh,
so you have to understand your own idiosyncratic way of doing it.
So the idea that if you had to give a chapter to your editor on, say, tomorrow, then tonight, then tonight you'd be writing it.
Well, I would have started a week. I mean, I knew when you have to write it, you can't get one chapter done in one night. And I knew that. So I would start a week before it was due. I would start getting really serious.
You know, it's interesting. We've been talking, you're a writer, obviously, and we've been talking a lot about what it takes to write. And I've interviewed so many writers. And one writer whose name I forget, but he's pretty well known, said for him, it's excruciating to write. He says, for me, the joy, even the liberating feeling, is having written. And,
yes.
And I just latched on to that. I think we can apply that to a lot of other parts of our lives that have nothing to do with writing a book. But sometimes it's really hard.
It is. It is really hard. And you know what I just did? Have you heard of National Novel Writing Month?
Oh, well, only because you include that at the end of your book, right?
Yes. It's you write a novel in 1 month. And it's an international program that this man named Chris Beatty started in the 1990s. And it's this, hundreds of thousands of people have done it. And you write a novel in 1 month. It's 50,000 words, and basically it's 1,700 words a day. And the idea is that you do it no matter what. And you have these groups, you go to a cafe and you write with other people. And I actually just did it.
Oh, you did?
And yes, just this last November. I cannot believe I did it. And it was excruciating, but somehow the idea that all these other people were doing it, and the idea that, okay, he says, you don't care how good it is, you know it's going to be bad. The idea is just to do it. And that is enormously liberating. And it makes it less excruciating when you just know it's going to be bad.
In fact, here's an email that he sent out to his friends and acquaintances. He said, hear ye, come one, come all, and dust off those word processing devices. This was back in 1999. Under the motto, a lousy novel is better than no novel at all, I have declared July National Novel Writing Month.
It was July back then.
It was July. Now, I guess now it's November.
Now it's November, yeah.
To celebrate, I want to write a novel in a month, and I want you to write one too. That's great.
Yes. I if anyone wants to write a novel out there, I urge you highly to do that, because I did it. I just wrote 50,000 words.
And is it as bad as you thought it would be?
Can you tell? It's as bad. I looked it over, and it's actually not as bad as I thought. And I can't believe the stuff that came out of me. It's just crazy. You can't believe what is there in your subconscious that's just waiting to get out there.
And was it also being part of a group? Did that also help sort of generate those juices?
You know, I didn't really join any of those groups for some reason. I saw the notes and I thought about getting out there. It was more just the idea that I actually announced on their blog that I was going to do it. that was my incentive. I said, I'm going to do this. And then I announced it to my friends on Facebook. I said, I'm going to do this. Halfway through, I said, I've written 25,000 words. And they were all encouraging. And that was enough for me. But for a lot of people, it's very important to meet with others, either online or physically, and do it.
In fact, you have a section in the book about if it is a kind of a group project that people are involved in, there are some do's and don'ts about sort of how to get the group to work together.
Yes. And that can be, you know, there can be a lot of ego involved. And actually, group collaboration can be just a wonderful thing. And that creates, that's got intrinsic accountability, which is so great. Because if you've got somebody else, I was just working on a project at work, and it didn't have a firm deadline. But somebody else, I said, can you please, you know, check in with me every week and make sure I've done this. And that was such a wonderful thing to help me get the different parts of it done. But I talked to this for the book on collaboration. This one collaboration just totally fell apart because it was ego, basically. And so that's the problem. If you know, when you're just yourself, your ego can handle it. But if there's, you know, colliding egos, I think that's the biggest danger to collaboration.
You suggest don't allow criticism, make sure everyone is included, monitor nonverbal behavior after a conflict, you know, kind of address if there are personal attacks or feelings are hurt, make sure you address them.
Right. You know how the introverts tend to hang back, and sometimes their opinions aren't regarded as much.
That's Phyllis Korke, our guest in this hour of Radio Time. She's assignment editor and reporter for the New York Times Sunday Business section, wrote an article about deadlines, and that got her thinking about the fact that as a young girl, she wanted to write a book. She hadn't written it yet, and so she wrote a book about how to write a book and the things that had prevented her from writing the book, and it's called The Big Thing, How to Complete Your Creative Project, Even If You're a Lazy, Self-Doubting Procrastinator Like Me. 1-888-477-9499. Margo, thanks for the call. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, talking with Phyllis Korke about deadlines and motivation and fear of failure, routines, getting big projects done. Let me get James from Glenside to join us. And James, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello, everybody.
Hi there.
Please pardon me. I'm a little nervous. You know, you are talking about me, and I love the approach that you're taking across the board, because it's not so much the big things for me, it's the little things.
Uh-huh.
Cleaning out the cellar, cleaning out the garage. But, Marty, if you came to me and said, can you help me clean up? I would be right there. So I'm not lazy.
Right.
I can do it for somebody else, but I don't think I'm worthy of it. And I'm going to a psychiatrist, a psychologist, and I have a feeling this book is going to do more for me than they've done.
Well,
and Marty, I have an end table full of books from your show that I have never read. So you know what I mean?
Exactly what you mean, James. No, I appreciate the call. Don't leave that psychiatrist yet, but at the same time, let me give Phyllis Korke a chance to respond to your comments. And he's saying, look, it's not like I want to write a book. I just want to clean out my basement.
Yeah. Well, two things. And I have trouble with that, too. Like, my dishwasher stopped working, and then the dishes started piling up. And do you ever notice, at least this is true for me, is the hardest part is to start. And if you just, and I just say, I'm just going to wash one dish, that's all. And then suddenly I'm picking up another dish and another one. And this is a principle of inertia at work. It's that when you aren't doing anything and you're just indolent, you tend to just stay that way. But if you switch it back around and then you start up kind of your internal motor, that keeps you tending to go in that direction. What I would actually do for my book is, it sounds kind of corny, but I would say the hardest part is to start.
Mm.
It has a ring to it.
Yep.
And I would just say, just get in the chair, just write one sentence. That's all you have to write. Well, sure enough, once I sat there and I had one sentence down, I started to write another one. And I would say that was something like cleaning out the cellar. Boy, I have closets that are a mess. And you go in there and just say, just just find one thing. And then, you know, if you feel like it, do another one. You know, the starting of it. And then the other thing is the power of increments. People tend to think that they have, when they have a big project or even a small one, which I would say cleaning out a cellar is actually, I would call that a big thing.
Sure.
And it's the idea, then they think they, and it's been going on, it's, they've been putting it off maybe for a decade, and they think they've got to do it all in one day. There's just this idea that because it's so big, they have to get it done all at once. But increments add up, and National Novel Writing Month proves that. You have 1,700-word increments across 30 days, and it miraculously does add up. And so don't equate the bigness of the project with the need to be big every single day.
Break it into bite-sized pieces.
Yes.
James, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me go back to something I've been reading about, but you also include this in your book, Phyllis, which is about taking breaks. And sometimes you can be working on a project and it's just, it's not moving, you're not making any kind of headway. And the thought of just getting up from your desk, walking around, maybe walk around the block or walk around a building, can actually get those juices flowing.
Yes, and I recently talked to a professor at Cornell, and actually for the book as well, but he gave me some further research recently that said the best way to work in general, not for everybody and not all the time, but is to sit for a certain amount of time, like say 10 minutes, stand for 10 minutes, mm-hmm. and then walk around. And what this does, moving from sitting to standing brings blood to your brain, and that improves your thinking, your cognitive abilities, as does moving around. And it's just good to, there's only a certain amount of time that we can focus on one thing, and we need to sort of shake it up a little bit. And then when you come back, you find that you have new insights. And you know how the unconscious and intuition, they definitely have an effect.
Well, even I've had producers who are, you know, waiting for someone to call back to book a show, and sometimes they'll take a walk, and lo and behold, the person calls back. So
yes.
I don't know if that's serendipity or exactly what that is.
And I'm a big believer in serendipity, too.
A question from Carol from Newtown. She says, how do you deal with external interruptions? Not the conversation we're having with ourselves, but people knocking on the door, the phone rings, all those things.
Yeah, that's definitely hard. I think, I don't know about knocking on the door. That's something you can't really, I don't know how you can stop yourself from answering that. But I think we do create our own external interruptions with email and with social media and things like that. And I think there are ways, I think sometimes those are, that's a problem of our own making. And we can turn off those email notifications. You can turn those off for 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. You can turn off your phone for 20 minutes and nothing horrible will happen. And I think as I said, even a 20-minute period, that's really the most we can really work anyway for a concentrated period is 20 minutes, usually, unless you're in that magical state of flow, which doesn't really happen that often. So I think for most of us, we can create a space, and both physical and technological, where we can focus for 20 minutes.
Do you think it's harder to get things done if you work from home, for instance, or you go to the office and go to work?
I think that depends on the person. Some people are really good working from home. I'm not one of them. I really need to be at the office to get my work done. It's a very individual thing, but I think if you're working from home, I think you really have to be aware of your own peculiarities and the mm-hmm. things that, like cats, I think are one of the worst.
That cats are will... Those damn cats.
You know how they tend to splay across the keyboard and that kind of thing. And so that, you know,
they're
you
not playing it right. Yes,
yeah,
exactly.
I know. So, and children and, you know, you have to be aware of, and right. sometimes, you know, those co-working spaces are good alternative.
Just to any listeners out there, I love cats, so I don't want anyone to misunderstand what I just said there. This is Ahmed from Wilmington.
I love them too.
Ahmed from Wilmington, Delaware. Ahmed, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You're
great
welcome.
Show as always, Marty.
Thank you.
Just wanted to say, you know, I couldn't agree more with your guests about taking breaks when you have a big task or a small task. Something that I found that works well for me that was suggested to me was something called a Pomodoro time technique, which is basically, you know, setting yourself a timer that's no longer than 15 or 20 minutes, and every 15 or 20 minutes you take a break for about 5 minutes or so, and then the timer goes off after that break, then you come back and do it more and more. And those, as your guest said, the increments really add up. It's a great way for me. You know, I'm a writer. I do a lot of work where it just requires a lot of sort of fluid thinking and constant working and thinking. And something like that really does help me because I'm also somebody, as your guest mentioned, who would start a task even if it was difficult to start, but once I started, I wouldn't want to stop until it's finished. So that would prevent me often from starting another task because sure. I knew I wouldn't be able to stop. But that Pomodoro technique really did help.
Oh, that's so interesting. I mean, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Phyllis, anything you want to say in response?
Oh, I've heard a lot about the Pomodoro technique. And actually, I have a section in the book on dissertation writers. There's this whole category of people called ABDs, all but dissertations, yes. Dissertation. And these are some long-suffering people. And that is something that group really recommends, is that Pomodoro technique to get that done. And I want to try it. Thank you for reminding me.
You did also interview, I guess, people that would be successful in that they seem to be able to accomplish all this stuff without all the anxiety and all the tricks that you need to get something done. What do they do, or what do they know, or what do they have that we don't have?
I wish I knew.
Really?
They just have an iron will. Some people, I don't know. I think it's they just have the, maybe it was their upbringing or something biological or genetic that they just are, they have amazing self-discipline. I don't know what the percentage is. I think it's a very small percentage. I also talked to some people who are known as short sleepers, where they don't require as much sleep as the average person, maybe just 2, 3, 4 hours a night. Mm-hmm. And so they basically have like a whole extra life where they can get things done.
Wow. Wow.
It's not fair.
No, it's not fair at all. You also described an executive that it sounds like he climbs a mountain every day. Am I overstating that?
Yeah. Well, he works at the Mayo Clinic. Yes. And he works at Arizona State. And I went with him one day. I went down there and he climbs a mountain. And it's sort of a template for completion. And he told me, even if I don't get anything done the rest of the day, at least I've done that. Mm-hmm. And, of course, it's a really good physical activity as well. He's the one who's a short sleeper. So he also is, like, up until, like, 3 or 4 in the morning getting his novel done, in addition to being a professor at ASU and a doctor at the Mayo Clinic.
And also climbing mountains every day.
Yes.
That's pretty wild.
I know.
Really. I'm exhausted. Let me get Patricia from Center City, Philadelphia to join us. No, go ahead, Phyllis.
I just say, you know, these people are so rare, and you hear about them because they're, you know, they stand out.
Let's see what Phyllis from Center City, Philadelphia has to say. Hi, Phyllis. Go ahead. You're on the air. Oh, excuse me, Patricia. I got my peas mixed
I'm Phyllis.
Up there. You are Phyllis. And you are Patricia. Go ahead, Patricia.
Not a problem. I'm very much enjoying this conversation, and I was moved to call in because several of the things that the guest was offering as good things to do, I have found in the practice of yoga. When she talks about learning to breathe correctly, you're certainly going to learn that if you have a yoga practice, as well as the physical asana, the postures are another way to develop a good posture and a good way of holding yourself. And then there's also the component of the concentration, the focus.
Sure.
That's what yoga is really all about. And I feel like it's a great place for anybody who's trying to get those qualities. So I just wanted to offer that.
Absolutely. Patricia, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Phyllis, sounds like you agree.
Oh, absolutely. I've done some yoga, and I've heard people say that as well. There's many different routes to this, but I think it's just in general realizing that there is a mind-body connection.
We have a comment from Nell. She says, my nana used to say, once begun, half done. I repeat this to myself as I begin and complete projects. So having a kind of a mantra like that. Then Allison has an email here. She says, procrastination may provide the time for reflection. And there's probably a reason we're procrastinating, Phyllis. I mean, maybe it's not necessarily a good reason, but there might be some benefits to that as well.
Oh, I totally agree. And I think for me, it was good to procrastinate 40 years on my book. I couldn't have written it until I was in my 50s. And in a way, that sort of, there was a sort of inner psychic nagging that was going on that caused me eventually to do it. And I think, too, it gives it a chance, this project, to marinate in the back of your brain for that backroom work to happen. So there is definitely a good side to it. I think, though, when it starts to get really upsetting and cause anxiety, that's when you really have to look at it, and it's more of a negative thing.
You interviewed a woman, Anne Bancroft, the first woman to reach the North Pole either on skis or a sled. But she had these beautiful descriptions, in a sense, about being lost.
Yes.
And what you can learn, I guess she was literally lost or perhaps stuck in her tent as some storm came in. But I thought she had some pretty interesting philosophical thoughts and advice.
Yes, she talks about being up there and you're in a white world and you look around and you have no idea where you are. And all you can do is put the GPS device under your arm for it to warm up, and then it gives you the location, but you're just totally lost. And I think that's a really good metaphor for working on a big thing. And that's what makes it so scary as you reach, and that's what makes it so meaningful, as you reach this point where you have no idea what you're doing and you've gone out there and, you know, you've journeyed a little bit of a ways out, and there's so many different directions you could take. What's the right one? What if you take the wrong one? Mm-hmm. It's dangerous. It feels mentally dangerous. And she made me realize this. It's a sign that what you're doing is worth doing.
Let me squeeze Michelle. Oh, whoops. No, sorry. Roger. Oh, Michelle, Roger. Let's do Michelle. Sorry. Michelle from Malvern. Michelle, we're almost out of time, but just a quick question, if you don't mind.
Oh, hey. Thank you, Marty. I started an illustrated motherhood diary. Me, Carter.
You know, Michelle, I hate to do this to you. We just, unfortunately, we have a terrible phone line, and I apologize. We cannot take your question. I see here she says, I have a 25-year project. I want to get to the next step. I don't know what to do. And that seems a little vague, but also really important, Phyllis. And I imagine people are coming with you with a lot of questions like that.
Oh, yeah. And it's just that time to really sit down and analyze, why do I want to do this? And, you know, do I want to continue or should I give up? And it's okay to give up. That's, you know, and then if you feel like you do want to continue, try some of these fake accountability strategies and the Pomodoro technique that the caller recommended, things like that. Really take some pragmatic, practical steps and incremental steps to finish.
Are you going to write another book?
Yes, I am. I just wrote that one, and I'm going to take a look at it. And about, I showed it, gave it to a few friends for them to comment on, and I am going to write another book. Here, there, I've said it.
It's on tape, just so you know.
Yes. Can you play it back for me?
I will. I will call you every morning, and I'll be your dairy farmer. How's that?
Okay.
Phyllis Corky, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
And she's assignment editor and reporter for the New York Times Sunday Business section. Her book is called The Big Thing, How to Complete Your Creative Project, Even If You're a Lazy, Self-Doubting Procrastinator Like Me. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about the program. I'm Marty Moscowing. Thanks for joining us.